Welcome back to the Financial Coconut Podcast Network, the leading personal finance podcast network in Singapore. I'm your host, Reggie, aka Your Chief Financial Coconut, and every Thursday, you will finally get to chill with us. We will be bringing on some of the quirkiest, geekiest, leading voices in the personal finance space to give them ample time to talk about their stories, the lessons they have learned over time, and some good advice for all of us. What has aged well? What didn't do so well? Why did they do what they do? So sit back and chill with TFC.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Because I think when people are thinking of starting, especially I think for a lot of our listeners, they're more like you, right? Full-time corporate job, yep. And then like, because some excess income, then the butt itchy, right? They see a few hundred thousand.
Everything
the,
itchy.
Itchy, then like, well, maybe hey, three of us start a restaurant together lah, or three of us start a bar, right? That's yeah. that's the narrative.
Yes, don't do it.
That is the narrative.
That's the narrative, the butt itchy. Why are we in studio today?
We'll talk about the pros and cons of
10 reasons not to do F&B.
10 reasons not to do F&B. Yeah. 10 reasons to do F&B.
We got 10 reasons to do F&B. There's no 10 reasons
if
to do F&B.
If you're a millionaire, you want to be a millionaire, you can.
You can, if you're already there.
If you're a billionaire and you want to be a millionaire, you can. That's what he said.
If you feel like donating money.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right,
yeah.
Oh my goodness.
You can donate money to CPF, donate money to your employees, money to,
to the landlord,
Singapore,
to customers.
Yeah.
All the good stuff, okay? So yes, today we are in studio to talk a little bit about how to build a successful F&B, right? Although I look at you laughing because I know you're closing down your shop, right? But there's always a lot of lessons to learn in the process.
Yeah.
So it's not just always just about copying the successful person because there are a lot of rules of the trades that, you know, sometimes people don't even realize it is what it is, right? Yeah. So before we roll, maybe you want to introduce yourself, you know, what do you do and all that jazz for the audience?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. So my name's Yichen. I used to or am currently in the final stages of closing down a cocktail bar called Jekyll and Hyde. So the bar itself has been around for about 10 years. You know, I took over the business about 5.5, almost going on 6 years ago. We did a bit of expansion, which we can talk a bit more about later, de-expanded, shrunk, and then went out closing the business. On the other side, I have a day job in finance. It's always been my main source of income. F&B has always been my main source of expenses.
Okay. And yourself?
My name is Park. I am the second gen chef owner of Bagi Sore. The business itself has been around since 1989. I took over pretty much during the peak COVID period. That was 2020. But I pretty much grew up around the business, you know. So a lot of the older folks, when they come over to the restaurant, they will remember me as the kid that was running around, pretty much child labor back then, you know, so running around and I was like still in primary school.
You sure you want to say that?
So when does your kid become child labor?
Yeah.
About 11.
So that's about
8 more years.
Okay. We'll note on that.
We'll come by.
And say, hey, third generation.
You know the thing about being a kid and working in a restaurant when you're that young, right? The tips are fantastic.
Oh, because they look at you like, oh, what?
Oh, you're so cute. Yeah.
That's the thing.
Oh. Okay. Wait, is it poor thing or is it so cute? Or is it just like a little bit of both? Yeah. Okay.
But actually, Pagi Sore, when I was growing up, obviously I didn't know him. We just went there as a family to makan.
Okay, so it's been around, household brand, right? Everybody knows you.
Is we've been around in the CBD pretty much the entire length of the 30-odd years, you know.
Yeah.
So you guys also have had a couple other outlets before, which I think that's where we used to go dine at too.
So we had, I think, a couple of outlets. Like, I think we had another one in Tanjung Pagar. Mm. And then at one point, we had one in Jurong. Mm. Yeah, that was when we thought it was a good idea to expand. Obviously,
I think everyone who has expanded has either struggled to stay open. Okay, not everyone. Like, there are other concepts, obviously, that have expanded and I think they're doing just fine. But I think it takes a certain type of concept to
so loaded. There's so much to unpack.
Yeah.
Right. There's so much to go. Okay, but let's start with the high level, right? So sure. A lot of people, I mean, I got you guys in studio because a lot of people are thinking about it, right? You know, okay, I have a decently good paying day job, you know, and I want to like create a side hustle. I want to do a restaurant, you know, like everybody have that thing, lah. Like do a cafe, do a restaurant, do a bar, you know, like somehow I don't know who planted this shit in people's head.
Is this the moment we look at? Don't do it. The moment you get a good paying day job, hey, don't do it.
But you get where I'm coming from, right? Like, a lot of people think like that.
Yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from, right? But it's good that you've got two sides of the story today, right? Because I guess that's more me, and then Park is really doing it full time, right? And I think if you look at it from different perspectives and how a business should be run, I mean, I don't think it's just necessarily just F&B, right? But it's just generally how you manage a side hustle. It's how operationally intense a side hustle might be, how much time or effort you have to put into that. And F&B is definitely something that you can't let your eye or even your hands off, I guess.
So the answer is don't do lah.
I think the thing is, I mean, if you're going to pay your money, there are better ways to do it. Like, you know, there's a lot of things you can waste your money on, you know. But at the end of the day, I feel that with F&B, a lot of people, they tend to be a lot more focused on the cons, the pros, the good things about F&B. And they tend to like just sideline all the things that can go wrong.
Yeah.
You know, all the problems that come with F&B.
So what are the good things of F&B that you think people think?
To be honest, I would think that if in general you don't have a passion for food or what, that's pretty much the only thing that sustains you. Yeah. Because every day it's long hours, day in, day out. You know, you're just facing a lot of people. You're facing a lot of pressure, right? So, I mean, at the end of the day, if you don't actually love food, and I don't mean, oh, I love eating food. No, you actually don't love dealing with food and you don't love dealing with people. You shouldn't choose this business, you know, right? Because I think people have the idea that it might be easy to, right? It's just serving food. I mean, look, most of the time, the service part is like a very small fraction of what is happening.
I think depending on the concept, right. But yeah, I get where you're coming
pretty
from.
Pretty much everything else is about like worrying about the food, worrying about the people, you know, worrying about how they would look at your food, how they would feel about it, you know, worrying about whether the quality is there, worrying about standards are there, you know, worrying about SFA, worrying about government things, you know, worrying about manpower.
About COVID.
You get what I mean? All of that worry just goes into like maybe a 2-hour service.
Yeah.
You know, all of that compacted into 2 hours of service. And that's the 2-hour thing that everybody sees. Like, oh, wow, you look so crowded, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But everything else that happens behind.
They don't see the prep before that. Right. They don't
that
see
where the problems are.
Staff that are late or... Because they always see what is in front of them, right? And obviously, unless things are like super bad, which I guess has happened before where you're severely understaffed or, you know, I don't know, water's leaking from the wall, which has happened for us before.
Shophouse, right? Yes.
So people always ask me like, you know, how did I get into it or why did I get into it? And I always answer, and my answer is it's a combination of negativity, stupidity, and idiocy, right? It's a combination of all three because, I mean, to Park's point, it really is being naive, right? About going into a business where you think, I mean, I'm going to be completely blunt about it. I thought that it would be an easy side hustle where I would be able to hang out with friends, you know, it would pay me some money on the side. But if I'd taken that money and I just put it in the stock market, I've done a lot better, right? And I'm just like looking at it and like, okay, I won't swear that, but
it's okay.
Many forms of swear words and all that and stuff like that. I was like, what the hell? I should really have done that, right? But you can't really know that until you do it. So I guess I think Park and I are here to warn you of the
struggles,
potential issues that you might face before you do that. And I know a lot of friends that run different concepts, right? And you know, they have different struggles. I mean, during COVID, I think a lot of the F&B people all banded together and we still band together. Like right now when I'm trying to sell all the crap up from my restaurant and stuff like that, I just spam it in the group chats and people are like, oh, I want this, I want that and stuff like that. And it's support in both ways, right? One, they need the item, but two, also it's supporting in terms of buying that. And I think, you know, when we were going through COVID and everyone was going through the same shit where things were opening, closing, open, close, open, close, at least there were people that you could relate to. And I think F&B, for what it's worth, I have a corporate job too, right? It's actually one of the more congenial industries where people actually do help each other, which is, I think, maybe not that it surprised me, but I was pleasantly surprised, I guess.
In what sense?
I have a shop next to park, right? I'd be like, hey, crap, I ran out of lime leaves, okay, or something like that. And I'll be like, hey, bro, can I borrow like 3 packets of lime leaf tomorrow? I return you and stuff like that. There's this inherent like trust where it's just like, yeah, sure, you go take the 3 lime leaves tomorrow, you return the 3 lime leaves, right? And I think that's, and or you might be like, hey, oh, okay, Indonesian restaurant cannot drink alcohol. So, but if it was an Indonesian restaurant, it might be something like, hey, why don't you go over there to have drinks after there? Or we might say like after drinks, we're like, hey, why don't you go and makan over there, right? It's like kind of like, let's help each other out kind of thing.
Great. Just for context, I used to run a tea house.
Oh.
That was 8 years ago. So okay. We're in the same boat.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, so I understand this thing inside out. Whatever you're saying, I know the kind of struggle. So it's a different concept, okay. But we're in the same SFA, the fire department, everything. Yeah. Right. So I get what you guys are saying. So maybe for our audience, right, just to kind of help them understand, you know, like what are the struggles that they're missing out? Because people all think of it, 衣食住行, right? They always think of this stupid idea that, oh, people need to eat, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like all these like assumptions. But what are all the problems that you've experienced so far? And then from a business side of things, right, I think we can break down to different segments, right? Like maybe first we start with the concept. Like, you know, everybody have like all sorts of ideas in their head. You know, like what are some things that you think people need to be aware of?
You know, the thing is this, right? It's true. People need to eat, you know.
Why at your restaurant?
Yeah, why do I eat your food? why yours? You know, why whatever you're putting on the plate? You know, I think people don't understand. It is a lot easier to be sitting down as a customer. Yes. Than to be the one that's putting the food on the table.
Yes, if you love a cafe, just cafe hop all your life.
I mean, if you're looking at how you start an F&B business, I mean, there are a few different factors, right? Location is actually very important. Two, concept does matter, but the location ties in with the concept, right? Because if you have a bar in, I don't know, like in the middle of class or something like that, you probably won't get as much footfall, right? Yeah. I mean, if you have a cocktail bar there, okay. If you have a beer bar there, you might get very good footfall because everyone's going there, right? So, I mean, the concept tied in with the location matters. I mean, I think secondly, you know, with that, you're also looking at what people want because things change. I don't know about people in Singapore. People in general are fickle people and they want to try different things.
What's so unique about
Singaporeans
is that they're not fickle.
Yeah. No, so
in fact, in a high density environment where there's just like new concepts popping up, down,
so
left, right, right. It's always
bouncing
competing.
Around
stuff
like that,
exactly.
Right? So they might eat at Pagi Sori one day, then they go to Jekyll and Hyde. You won't see these people for another year.
Yeah.
Because they have another 50 weeks of other restaurants and bars to try.
Yes, exactly. Okay.
After so many years of like, I think, looking at the business, growing up with the business, and now running the business, I've come to the conclusion that whether or not your restaurant is successful, it's not something you really need to overanalyze.
Mm.
Number one, your food needs to be fantastic.
Okay. Fantastic is the word, right? Not good, right?
Yeah, like, fantastic, okay. Right? Number two, you just need to be really lucky. I don't even think that location even matters. You know, I mean, this is Singapore. You can get from one end to the other end in like, what, I don't know, 40 minutes? Yeah. And now we have the train system over the place, you know? So when you overanalyze and then you're like, oh, I'm looking at location, whatever, all you're looking at is just where will your rental be higher? You know, a lot of all this cost, right? But at the end of the day, if your food is really good, and
people will travel for the food.
This is one thing, right? And then if you open your shop at pretty like nondescript location, you know, something that's not very fancy, but people like your food, that's where they will go.
But you had a brunch in Jurong.
Just
to kind of push that idea a little bit, right? Like, did people go down there or were you just serving like the Westies?
So pretty much the thing is because the main shop has always been at Telok Ayer. So when we had a shop at, say, Jurong, we served pretty much the Westies because then they didn't need to come out.
Yeah.
You see? But now I do not have the shop at Jurong. They are coming back here. Because this is where they can get the food.
Did it cannibalize or it didn't? It just expanded?
It actually didn't. Because, I mean, as much as Singapore is small, people can travel and move around.
Yeah.
But you reach a new target audience you know, where they are just within that area.
I'm an Eastie and I will not go to Jurong.
Correct. <I know>.
Just for food.
Simple as that.
The lie is in the middle, but no. Jurong.
So, I mean, the thing is this, right? So, you won't go to Jurong for any other reason. I stay in the East. Yeah. I'm not going to go there, you know, for unless the food is fantastic.
Yeah.
If the food is so fantastic that
it's worth a day trip.
You know, I'm just going there just to eat and leave. I have no other attachment there.
Yeah.
I will.
Okay.
You see? And that's what I feel that that's how it is. I mean, in the past, the CBD area used to be a place where, because for us, we're a halal restaurant, right? We don't serve alcohol. You have almost no reason to come for dinner. Most people, they want to have some drinks with their food. You know? So dinner used to be like a one table or two table affair. But nowadays, we actually, sometimes we can get pretty busy, you know, to the point whereby I might have to like ask my staff, or rather beg my staff, can you stay behind and help, you know? Because nowadays people are okay to travel out, you know? They're like, hey, I'm going to travel to the right. But they know there's nothing there. They're just here to eat your food. And then they're just going to...
Which is the mark of a good restaurant. Like, correct. Right at the end of the day, because so people are traveling
that
there.
Makes you, but that is the part that makes you feel like, hey, you know, I'm doing something right. Because my food is good enough to bring the people in, right? I don't have to have like a certain gimmick. I don't have to like offer a certain discount, right? I don't have to hold noodles and dance. You're coming here for the food.
Bro, that's oddly specific. Right, then got the music at the back, right? Then put it to the pot.
Or like, I don't know, a beer can in a chicken. But you get where I'm coming from.
I get it. But it's a bit of a snob. It's a food snob.
But right? It's good home cooked. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, Pagi Sorry is good.
I get
home,
it.
Home cooked food, but restaurant quality.
No, yeah, I get it. I mean, the thing is,
I am not a fan of gimmicks.
But let's be clear, it works, right? From a capital recycling standpoint, some of these people, when they put the money in...
It works to a certain extent. Yeah, it works for a certain period of time. Yeah. Okay, like, so, I mean, I think for the examples that he brought up, I mean...
This is a very OG way of doing it.
Go there because they like hot pot overall, right? And the noodles happen to be an extra part of it. And it's an overall experience as opposed to just like, you know, just the makan lah, right? But I mean, like, I went to another hot pot place the other day. And I was like, oh, actually, this is better quality, right? And the price point ended up being the same. So it depends on what you want to pay for it.
Yeah.
But to be fair, like, for example, when we talk about gimmicks, right? There is a difference between already having fantastic food and then doing a gimmick. Or rather than you say, I depend on the gimmick to draw people in. That's where I think the difference is very clear.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's interesting. So Holland Village, you know, they just opened up over there, right? And it's a dog-friendly mall, right? So I went to a cafe that was a dog-friendly cafe. So everyone can bring their dog there and it's full. Oh my God, I hope they don't listen to this. The food was terrible. The food was really bad. Like, it's just like freaking like the sausage, you know, it's a frozen sausage. Fries, you know, it's frozen. Broccoli, you know, you're like, oh my God, this is probably broccoli from the bag, not even the broccoli that you chop and then you steam the damn thing, right? So then I was like looking at the food and I was like, oh my God, it's $30. What the f***? Wow. I was like, oh wow, this is damn expensive. And I was like, wow, if this is full, because they were serving a need. They were serving a need where people cannot go anywhere else, or there are a limited number of places where they can bring their pet indoor. They can actually sit indoor and eat and have your pet lah, right? And so then I was just like, will this place last? And I was like legitimately thinking about it. And I'm like, I wonder if because they are serving this pet need and people are taking care of their pets more, they don't really care about the quality of the food. But then to your point, if the food was even 2 times better, doesn't have to be 10 times better, if it was twice as good, dude, I think like, it would be even more packed. I think the lines would be long, right? And so it goes back down to quality, because I think there's only so much that you can sustain after a while. Like, I don't want to go back. I'll bring my dog somewhere else rather than go to this cafe where I have to pay $30.
I'll sell my dog.
Exactly. Oh, okay, like, I wouldn't do that. Like,
I wouldn't want to pay.
But you wouldn't go there. You just go to another place where you could do it, right?
The thing is this. So if, let's say, the exact same shop, a rival opens next door, same idea. You can bring your pets, you can bring you can bring a turtle or something, but much better food.
Do I look like I own a turtle? Right? I used to. Oh shit, you own a turtle. Okay.
So, you cannot bring turtle. Yeah. You can only bring dog.
Nowhere does it accept turtle.
So what happens then? And I think it should be quite expected that business will start shifting to the other side already.
Yeah. If it was, I mean, that's economics, like if all things were equal, right? But that's where like things aren't all equal, I guess. And so then you have to look at it from that perspective too.
I mean, the thing is, I grew up around the kitchen my entire life, you know, and I was trained by my mom, right? So to me, food has always been more important than anything else, right? If I could, I would never renovate my restaurant for like 20 years.
You'll be one of those.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't mind my restaurant you being there. Oh, so like, cute. Yeah, you start in the 80s, correct, you know, that type of places. Yeah.
Sometimes the food is better if it looks...
Just that I just don't want to spend money on renovation. Yeah. I don't mind having like a house ghost or something that. Yeah. Like, I'm okay, you know. Maybe that's my gimmick. Like, I don't know, right? But the thing is, all your resources goes to focusing on the food.
Yeah.
Right? People wouldn't come to my place to sit for 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
They would just come to my place because they want to eat a good meal and then get lost.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess like a good example would be Zicai restaurants, right? It doesn't matter how dirty the damn place is. If the Zicai is good, people will go. Actually, the dirtier the place, the better it is, because the wok is more burnt, the, I don't know, the plates are more chao ta or whatever, and so there's more flavor infused into it or something like that, right? So, I mean, that is. And if you go, like, what? You go to KL, you go to all these different places, eating on the street is where you get bought better tasting food, right? I don't know about better quality or better hygiene, but it's better tasting food, right?
And don't forget, you know, it is because of all these things that you spend on, like I said, renovations, you know, decorations. Mm. That's why your food gets expensive. Right, but I, for one, I'd rather pay for food at a good price, but good food.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But that's essentially a part of the core product, right? So because depending on different people's concept, right? Some people, it's like the food is decent, but the concept also encompasses the experience of the place.
Right.
There's a lot to go into the nitty gritty of it.
But that's the thing, you see. So I don't come from the idea of an experience, right? That is... I had a lot of phase growing up around the business, right? I had a lot of phases, you know. I had the phase where I start to think like, you know, oh, it's
think
about
too much,
you know, oh, it's about an experience. I have to create an experience for the people. When they come in, they must woo, you know, they must take photos, they must like that, you know. The service needs to be an experience. And then I go to the phase whereby it's like, that's all you know. So I would say that if people were to rate my restaurant, usually from my reviews, it's like ambiance, I don't know, 3, you know, or maybe 2, you know. Service, I don't know, when my staff are in a good mood, 5. When they are in a not so good mood, 3, you know. But food needs to be a consistent 5.
Okay.
And that's where I think is the most important thing for me, because, well, that's the thing you're here for.
Yeah.
Fair.
Right? You're not here for entertainment, you're here for food.
Fair.
You can call it an experience or something. I mean, I wouldn't mind paying for an experience every now and then. How tiring would it be to go to every restaurant and need have an experience?
But I think that's why different places serve different needs, right? They serve different concepts, serve different needs. So, like, you know, I've always said I'll never go back into F&B. And if I do, and I've talked about it, right? Because I think, one, I probably will 90% never go back into it. But if I were to do it, you either serve mass or you serve very high-end. Because high-end is, okay, about experience. Mm. Lower-end is about volume, okay? I mean, I think when you're in the middle, except for a few exceptions, like maybe say Pagi Sore, you are stuck in the middle and you're competing with everyone who is serving the middle, right? And so then you have Japanese food or Thai food or Italian food or whatever, which is... maybe say, okay, now costs are going up now, right? So maybe like $20 or $30 a plate or $15 a plate or something like that. But, you know, when you look at it from that perspective, I've always said I will go low-end, as low as possible. Because with high-end, you have other problems. You have to hire staff that are skilled. You have to hire staff that have good service. You have to make the place look nice. Everything, all the things that Park talked about happens at a high-end restaurant. And so the moment...
it needs to be consistent.
Exactly.
You know?
So say the maitre d' suddenly disappears or... don't know, your chef gets stabbed by another chef. I don't know, something happens, right? And you lose that element. You're like, fuck, I mean, what do I do now, right?
I mean, imagine, right, you go to a place, you're expecting the guy who's dancing with noodles to dance really well, but then it's just like...
and then suddenly it's wiggling, the three of us doing the dancing instead. And then you're like, what the hell is this Reggie Ichen and like Park doing with the dancing and stuff like that, right? Whereas, and it's also about staff. Okay, so for me, like, we had cocktail bartenders, right? So they are skilled. You cannot... I don't know about you. Okay, you can't. I don't know about you. I can't. I can make very simple cocktails, right? But it's not like I can go and make like an amazing cocktail, right?
It's different,
but
yes.
If I said, can all of us go to a chicken rice shop and cut chicken or chop chicken? Not to say that it's a very low skill thing, but I feel that we
better
could
be clear.
Oh yeah, it's not a low skill thing, but I feel that the barrier to entry is slightly lower, and that's why you can hire a wider range of people, where you can hire people from 20 to 60, right?
Sorry, at
a
cocktail just to let everybody know,
cutting chicken hard.
Yeah, cutting chicken.
Cutting chicken is a complex.
Cutting chicken well.
Yeah.
Is actually
maybe
a skill.
The economic bihun, the pig, the thing.
Okay,
one, that one is different. Yes.
If you do yong tau fu and it's all pre-packed yong tau fu, and you just put the thing out and then you take all the soda. That's an example, right? You mix the thing around that. But I think the whole point around it, essentially, or the point that I'm trying to make is, it's barrier to entry is lower, right? Like, I also generally probably would not have a 60-year-old bartender, although that might be a gimmick. That would be more of a gimmick at that point.
In Malacca,
the
there's a
really
bar,
good,
right?
Like,
it's like that.
Yeah,
it's so cute.
Yeah, no, so I mean like skilled labor versus unskilled labor. I mean, that's again the whole concept that you want to do, right? Because, I mean, cafe food, there's two types of cafe food, okay? That is like your hawker style Western food where you are willing to pay $7 or $8 and you get a certain type of cafe food, quote-unquote cafe food. or you go to Surrey Hills Grocery and you have to pay $40 for cafe food, right? Like, what's the incremental difference? What's the incremental cost? What's the incremental experience that you have? I mean, like, when I went there, I was like, oh my God, this is damn expensive, lah, right? And I was like, okay, the food's not bad, but would I pay that incremental amount for that? And you have to factor that into, you know, how people look at it also. Mm.
But from a business perspective, how do you kind of factor your costs? How do you kind of do your pricing, you know?
All, I don't know about him. Stuff. Mine was always 30%. So 30% maximum cost for your food and drink. And then, you know, everything else goes into that. I don't know about you.
I mean, the thing is this. Of course, there is some percentages involved. Of course, there's some calculation and math involved. But without trying to oversimplify it, yeah. I tend to price my things at what I think I would pay for them. Right? Because if even I wouldn't pay for them, then why am I expecting someone else to pay for them? Right? Because my mantra, I mean, the way I teach my staff is very straightforward as well. If you're going to serve a dish that you can't serve to your family, you can't serve to your children, don't serve the damn dish to customers. Right? Because people are paying money for this.
Yeah. Instead of eating at home, right? Right?
Yeah, right? Yeah. So sometimes, I mean, I have like customers who are like, you know, they come to me because they know I'm the owner, right? So they come to me and they'll be like, hey, today's fish is not so good, you know? My first question is, do you finish it? They'll be like, yeah, we finished it. I said, why do you finish it? I would have thrown it away. I'll give you a brand new one. Yeah. Why do you finish it? Because at the end of the day, fact of the matter is you paid for something. You expected freshness. You expected quality. So if there's something wrong with the food, you should tell us. Not finish it and then come and tell me it wasn't that good.
Sometimes people just want to be nice, right?
Yeah, I know. But the thing is, telling me about it is not being nasty. There are people who can be nasty.
Yeah, right. Yeah, fair.
So I think it's just that there should be some kind of a fair treatment. You are a paying customer, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
A lot of times I do come from the point of view whereby if I'm a paying customer, would I want to pay this price for a certain dish?
Fair.
So over, like, for example, I mean, during the COVID period, and then, you know, where things just kept going, getting more and more and more expensive, there are dishes that I don't bother raising their prices because I felt that, like, any higher and it makes no sense to pay for this dish anymore. But I know for a fact people are raising the prices. So, but to me, it's like, I don't want to, lah, right? It's not that I don't have higher costs. My costs are constantly going up.
Yeah, I hear you. Essentially, it's not too different from a lot of other businesses, right? Where you try to model with some baseline margins that you want to know, but at the same time, you want to envision who's your target audience.
But I think there are a lot of... I think most of the business nowadays, they take cost into account like very, very strongly.
Yeah.
So that's why nowadays, I mean, you will see a lot of food compared to the past, I feel that you don't understand why you have to pay this amount. You know,
where I mean, they give you the broad-based explanation. The costs have gone up, so my price has gone up.
So the explanation is just, you know.
Very loaded. I like it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, it is also, I think a lot of them, they are just like, oh, the other shop went up, I should go up too.
Some lah. I mean, for us, like, we struggled to raise our prices because our prices were like high enough already. So at a certain point also, you hit that value point where people, again, don't want to come anymore, right? But then you're also like saying, oh my God, my oil prices went up by 60% or my chicken price went up by 30%. And you're just like, how the hell do I like balance this out, right? Because if people are used to paying, as an example, $25 for this Wagyu beef char kway teow and then you raise it to $30, you know, I think my staff are always like, well, people will come back and eat. And I'm like, well, you can't, I mean, for me also, it's a, you have to try it out and see whether you get an incremental drop of people coming to your restaurant, right? Or coming to your bar, because to a certain extent, you have to cover your costs too. So there's a fine line between cost covering and I guess like keeping your customers happy and survivability.
But essentially, you didn't survive, right?
Yeah,
so like you shut it down.
Yeah.
How did it look like financially?
Yeah. So I mean, everyone kept going on about how, oh, your rent must be very high. And I was like, no, actually, my landlord is very nice. My landlord was very good. They didn't raise the rent much. Even when we renewed our lease, I think he raised it by like less than 10%, like 5%, 6%, which is very nice because we know other landlords that raised it by like 60%. I heard someone told me 120%. I was like, what the hell?
I know.
Right?
The landlord like that, right? Is looking to raise.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, so, yeah.
And so for us, it was actually more a matter of revenue going down. And then obviously manpower costs going up a bit also. I think we were trying to scale and obviously there were costs associated with that. But I think, you know, things are trendy at certain times, right? Some of them, I think, stand the test of time. Some of them, you know, things ebb and flow, right? And so we got to a certain point where our fixed costs were fixed, but then our variable revenue was super variable and it hit an inflection point where it was just like losing too much money on a monthly basis.
So cocktail bar is going to be a failed concept going forward?
I mean, I don't think all cocktail bars are going to be a failed concept. I mean, you have to look at it from two different ways, right? One, if enough places fail, consolidation happens.
Then and you
if
become consolidation the last happens, three, right?
You're the last one that survives. Yeah. And if the last one survives, you'll do okay. If he's the last Indonesian restaurant standing, everyone will go because everyone's like, shit, I need to eat my belacan, my sambal belacan somewhere. I need to eat my chicken here or whatever, or my otah this here, right? I mean, I was talking to a friend about it who came over because a lot of the F&B people are coming over to, you know, again, buy some of the things and all that. And I was talking to one guy and I was like, everyone always has this projection of like things are going well, right? And it's not that they're projecting things are going well. They're just trying to get people to come to their place. And he was like, dude, man, in like dire straits. And you're just like, okay, not that I feel better, but I'm just like, okay, like, I'm not the only one that's like suffering. And I think if you look at the number of places that are closing now, it's also, you know, a sign of things to come because you're not looking at it just from a micro point of view, right? You're looking at it from a macro point of view. What are the factors that play into it? For us, like, I hypothesize everything, right? So
it's
we did well during COVID.
It's about the career.
I mean, so we were profitable during COVID because everyone was in Singapore. People had to spend money in Singapore and people couldn't travel, right? The moment things opened up, there was a spike for 1 month. I think like March or April where, like, wow, you're like, wow, this is up by like 30, 40%. And then the next month, it's like completely crashed because everyone was traveling. The people that could afford our food and drink are also the people who could afford to travel. And so if you look at a lot of the fine dining restaurants now, I think they are the ones that are suffering because why the omakase restaurants during COVID did amazing.
Yes.
You couldn't get a reservation 3 months or 4 months out, but now everyone can fly to Japan tomorrow.
Yeah.
I can tell you half of them are suffering and I can tell you half of them will close.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because why would I bother paying $300 for an omakase meal in Singapore when I can pay $700 for a plane ticket there, then go and pay $150 for the omakase while having it in an authentic Japanese, you know, place, right?
I mean,
country, I guess.
But. Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
What about you guys then? Like when you're kind of running your business, you know, like things like cash flow, things like all these kind of business mechanics, right? What do you look out for? Because essentially what he said is that his concept is no longer as trendy, right? And people kind of move out of this. So revenue came down and then, you know, the numbers don't make sense anymore, right? Not a landlord raising price, right? But what about you? I mean, you guys stood the test of time. You must have gone through multiple iterations, whether is it changing your menu line, making sure you hold a margin, you know, hiring well, adopting technology, blah, 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 all those things, right? Like, what are some key factors that you think people need to know to stay relevant in the F&B space?
But that's the thing, you see. So again, I mean, I suppose, okay, some people would consider me so-called like a veteran of this industry at this point of my life because I've really been in it for a long time, right? But again, I think I'm past that phase, you know? I'm past that phase of trying to analyze a lot of things, you know? Words like projections means nothing to me. You know, things like trying to evolve and adapt means nothing to me. The word relevance means nothing to me, you know, because the thing is, at the end of the day, I think the amount of focus and care that I put into my business goes a little bit beyond a normal circumstance because I see it as a legacy. I see it as something that was part of my life. You know, it's just, it's not like I felt like starting a business or I felt like starting a restaurant because, you know, I wanted a Michelin star or whatever, you know, it's not a whim. It's a legacy, right? So even if, for example, at some point of my life, I actually am not interested in F&B as a career, but I had an obligation because it was a legacy, right? So a lot of the things that I do tend to be because I just think they need to be done.
Okay.
You know, shifting over, for example, having to suddenly change over to delivery mode.
Mm.
It wasn't like, you know, adapt. It was like, you don't do, you die.
People
like to use these words, you know, but I never thought of them that way, right? I just thought of it as, again,
survival.
You're talking about as if you have options, you know, right? Nobody can come out. Why are you talking like as if you can like, oh, let me not do anything and then one day people will come out to eat again.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Let me like not pay my staff for 2 months, you know? Because at some point we had the option to like not pay the landlords because I think the government was subsidizing or
but
whatever.
But I think
right?
there's also like people who pivoted faster than others also. Like, right, yeah.
Right. So I think when it comes to like a scenario like that, I don't overthink a lot of things. I just look at it from a point of view whereby, okay, so now we got to go to like delivery mode, right? Is my food going to taste good when it reaches delivery, the customers? Yeah. How fast can I get it there? You know, who is going to get it there for me, right? So it's a very like, reacting to the situation.
I think you used to have a bunch of taxi uncles that were your beck and call, right? Like during COVID.
So during COVID, that time I called a friend. I was like, so the taxi drivers were, well, they were out of the job as well, right? I mean, they couldn't work. So I asked, you know, do you guys, I mean, I could at least with delivery mode, I can still make revenue. I can still have an income, right? You know, but I need to get the food to customers fast. I need to get the food. And who knows the roads better than them? Right, you guys got no income, why not you do each other a favor? Like, you know, it's like a partner up, right? So it started with one taxi, and then the next thing I know, I had like I think almost like 15 taxis. Like,
and we had to borrow taxis from him sometimes. I'd be like, bro, I need a taxi for my deliveries, right? Because we hadn't built that same level of skill when it came to delivery, I suppose,
right? Yeah, so I mean, so it was like it was quite nice to see. So at one point, I think the other shops in my on my stretch, they closed down one by one because they couldn't, you know, pivot fast enough. Right? So, but like on the big days, like Hari Raya and all this, so people look outside, it was a fleet of taxis just like all along the road, just like waiting for me to like bring out the food because all of them had to go out at the same time.
Yeah, you know?
And they were all Mercedes taxis. that was the part that was really cool because the first friend I went to, the mother actually drives a Mercedes taxi, right?
It's all the friends, all the khakis.
She will be the one, I'll be like, hey, I need another 2 cabs. Okay, I'll get it for you. You know, I don't know, they use a walkie-talkie or WhatsApp, you know, and be like, hey, I need 2 more cabs, you know, who wants to do today, you know, and then they start coming together. But it was a very beautiful scenario, right? So not only could we help ourselves, we could help someone else, you know? Right, it felt like a very community kind of situation.
Yeah,
but again, there was not much planning involved. It wasn't overthinking. Mm. You know, oh, I need to be able to get the best drivers in Singapore to do it. It wasn't. It was just reacting. Like I have a problem. You have a problem. Yeah. Let's help each other. Right. So it's always been that way for me. Right, but it might be again because I've been in it for so long that it never occurs to me to try to overthink things. It makes you really, like, a lot of times you overthink things, you miss the core point, you know, the main thing that you're supposed to be looking at, you start adding things to it, right? Next thing is, like, you wanted to build a Lego car, you know, next thing, suddenly you're like, you build an entire building and a car park and 20 other cars, but all you wanted to do was this in the first place.
Fair. Okay.
And I think your whole point around projections, I think COVID taught us that projections can be thrown out the window because you did not know what the hell was going to happen the next day or the next week or the next month,
and,
right?
And that's the thing, right? So a lot of people who think it's a good idea to go into F&B, why do they think it's good to go into F&B? Projections, you know? What do they base their projections off on?
Nothing.
And
they also think it's cool. I think it's the coolest factor.
I think there's some cool factor to it.
Every month, my business will go up by 10%.
How do you help you go up by 10%?
What was the basis for that? You know, or because you saw someone else being able to make that amount, you think that you can also make that revenue. Why would you? You know, unless you're selling exactly the same thing. And even then, like I said, there is a luck factor.
Then you're cannibalizing also on the business. Yeah.
Maybe the customers just don't like your face. It might be, you know, it can be such things, you know, that people just, I don't like you. Or the feng shui here, not so good.
I don't feel good here.
Very strange, right? So there is always this, because you're dealing, the problem with F&B, you're dealing with humans.
Yes.
Yeah. You're dealing with people all the time, and you're not dealing with one type of person,
you're
two type of person.
A lot of people.
It's a lot of personalities, a lot of different people.
What are some things that you've experienced and you've picked up over time that you totally did not consider before entering the space?
In what sense? I guess like in terms of...
In the business sense, you know. I mean, I get it. Like, we already passed the whole, like, our product must be good. So we already assume the product is good, right? But from the business standpoint, there's all sorts of things.
Okay, maybe I'll just talk about one thing. Manpower. Manpower is a... It is very hard, I think, to hire people now. I mean, I don't know. I'm fine with doing this. But like, I mean, the government, ridiculous. I mean, they are considering, I think, now doing a... special passes for, I don't know, CERTIS officers because they can't get enough people. So they're like, oh, we can get people from the Philippines and Taiwan and don't know wherever and stuff like that. And we're like, oh my God, why are you not doing this for F&B? You're doing it for nursing. I think there's even one for burlesque dancers. I think there's actually a special pass for the KTV hostesses. If you go and look at the different types of...
You see the guy, there was this fellow who... You know, when you want to hire an EP, you're supposed to list on the... on the government website, like you must show proof that you tried to hire Singaporeans.
Singaporean.
He actually put like a KTV entertainer or KTV dancer in the government portal.
Because you actually have a specific KTV license, but you don't have it for F&B. And the answer that they have is, oh, because you must give Singaporeans a job. And it just baffles me because you tell every Singaporean, don't go and do this. Please go be a white collar worker. Please go and do this. Then why the hell are you telling me that there are enough Singaporeans who want to do the job, right? And so there's this disconnect where everyone in the industry was saying, hey, we need a separate pass in the S-Pass. Please don't increase the amount. I think then you just like summarily increase the amount. I think the minimum salary that the S-Pass holders have to make. And you're just like, oh my God, you are definitely not listening to the ground. So I mean, aside to the fact that that's a diss to the government, I think holistically speaking, there just aren't enough people that want to do it. And so you have to find a solution to that, whether it's hiring people. But then hiring people means what? Bringing people from overseas. Don't have pass, not enough people. And you have to have X number of Singaporeans before you can actually hire more people, right? So how do you actually solve that? And that's not necessarily a solvable problem. I've had a lot of people say, oh my God, don't you feel terrible, sad that your place is closing and your staff will have a hard time finding a job? I'm like, dude, the freaking guys all got like 35, 33, 34, 40% raises. And they got a job yesterday. They didn't get a job tomorrow. They got a job yesterday because people need people so desperately to work in F&B. I've always said that if I, for some reason, lost my job, I can go to F&B tomorrow. I'll find a job. Pop will hire me.
Definitely.
He'll pay me a few K. I mean, sure, maybe I don't make as much as I do in my day job, but I know I can get a job.
But you can get a job.
I can get a job. You won't be freaking like serve customers because... it is that desperate in the industry for them. I mean, if you go and look at, I'll say all the different shops, especially the chain ones, they're like, oh, got a sign-up bonus. We will give you like 5 days a week. You know, only work 8 hours max, staff meal, trips. I don't know, trip home to Malaysia. I don't know, whatever. The perks are endless nowadays, right? Because they are fighting for
that, and
they
advertise the perks a lot more than like officers and all these like white-collar jobs do, right? Yeah. You don't see them advertising. You don't see Google say, hey, you know, come and work for us. These are just things that people talk about, but they don't actually put it out there. You don't see a banner outside Google that says, come work for us, you know, you have this, you have that, you have staff meal, you have a pool table. They don't say that, right? Whereas F&B, banner, banner, you know, just tell everybody, please join us.
And I think the thing about, second thing about F&B is that, like, I mean, again, coming from a corporate job, you're working with a different group of people with like different backgrounds, and it's interesting, right? Like, you learn to work with different people from all different walks of life and all that, and you just have to understand like how to work together, how to serve together, because it's a little different, I guess, in terms of how thinking about how you work together, how you manage people.
How is it different?
I mean, it's different in a sense that generally different issues that they face, I think, whether it's at home or whether it's in general, and so you just try to be a bit more accommodating or a bit more understanding when it comes to different personal issues they might face, I guess. Yeah. I think when I got into the industry, and then the person who sold the bar to me said that people in the industry, and I guess it's more bar industry in general, would have an issue, whether it's around like womanizing or like alcoholism or gambling or whatever. And I was always like, oh, this is BS. Like, everyone is a good person, right? And it's and yes, everyone in the industry are genuinely good people, but I think you do see maybe a few more bad hats. And I've had my fair share of experiences with that, unfortunately, I suppose.
I think that for me, the local scene when it comes to F&B, the key here is that F&B jobs, we talk about servers, we talk about chefs, these jobs are generally a choice, but they are never the goal. No parent would tell the son, when you grow up, you must be a chef.
Yeah.
You know, no parent would say that, in Singapore at least.
Except your mum.
Yeah. Oh, wow. My mom did.
This one no choice. This one is a legacy, right? You better take it on and carry on,
so,
right?
So, I mean, say for example,
but
for
generally
me,
speaking,
I mean,
generally speaking,
I have a daughter, right? So...
you already started seeding the idea?
No, I don't want her to be in F&B.
Yeah.
You see? So when I spoke to my mom, I mean, you know, because third gen, right? So I told my mom from like day one, I said, I wouldn't want my daughter to grow up into F&B. You see? Because I said, why would I want to put her through this? Right? But again, F&B is to me, it's a career that is a choice. If she somehow chooses it, she somehow shows like an aptitude for it,
then and a passion, yeah, and then a true love for
go
it.
Ahead.
Yeah,
I won't stop you. You know, I'm not going to be like, oh my God, you're going to go F&B clothesline. You know, it's not going to be like that, right? But if, let's say, as a parent, I wouldn't encourage her to go towards F&B. I wouldn't encourage her to be a chef.
Yeah.
Because it's a very, very tiring job.
Yeah.
You know, there are jobs that you can make much more doing much less.
I mean, I think you also have to look at the overall environment, right? And I mean, I think this may be going into the overall environment of like, okay, so as an example, I'll go back to using a quarter bar as an example, right? But for us, our costs are high. Costs in Singapore, alcohol tax is high. So when you buy, okay, so when you get a highball, okay, so a highball is soda water and whiskey, okay? When you get whiskey in Singapore, a bottle of whiskey at the very least is going to be about $40 or $50.
Supplier you can say price. That
you can buy the, yeah, supplier price. You can buy the exact same bottle of whiskey off the shelf in Japan for a fifth of the price, at $11 versus $50. And they're charging almost the same price for the freaking, for the drink in Japan. I mean, sure, it's a bit cheaper for some of the drinks and all that, but if you're doing cocktails, the cocktails are the same price. So you're telling me that the margins there are obviously exponentially bigger. I'm going to assume rental is roughly the same. Manpower is actually cheaper. And so then you look at it from the perspective of like, again, why are you punishing yourself in Singapore? You have to look at it from where you're doing it also,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I mean, I know a lot of... So I lived in the US for a while. People would do food trucks. Why can you do a food truck? Because a truck costs $20,000. In Singapore, the bloody truck costs you $200,000, right? So if you can do a food truck that costs you 20K, versus a food truck where you start at 200K, you're down 200K, how many bowls of nasi padang or how many bowls of beef rendang or how many cocktails do you have to stir from the bloody truck to be able to make your money back?
Yeah.
And that is, and the answer to that is maybe, you know, 800 more a day or like 8,000 more in your lifetime or whatever. It's exponential, right? And so, I mean, I think when we talk about F&B, you also have to look at it from the unique context of what Singapore
of course,
is, right? Because you can now go and bid for a hawker store and you can bid for a hawker store and the bloody hawker store costs $6,000 or $7,000 a month. And you say, how many bowls of nasi lemak does uncle have to sell before he can? And then at that point, the person who's paying for that is probably not uncle. It's probably a gung-ho, like 20-something year old who's like,
no, because uncle is on in the old scheme, right?
So, but if you look at, okay, if you read 8 days,
why are you reading 8 days?
No, it's like 8 days eats. I mean, they are a bit more viral on Instagram and all that. You'll see,
because we follow them.
Yeah, we follow. Okay, I mean, as in F&B, you have
hoping
to see, right?
They will feature us as well.
Yes, but you always see a young person close after 3 months. After 1 month of running the store, then I'm like, what the hell? You want no staying power. You close after 3 months or 1 year. And then clearly, you also just couldn't factor, to your point, where were your projections? Oh, I was going to sell 200 bowls of rice a day, so I definitely can make money. What you didn't factor in is not just whether two people will buy 200 bowls of rice. Can you cope with making 200 bowls of rice or not? Or are you like, by the end of it, sure, you sell the 200 bowls of rice, sure, you make a $500 profit. But oh my God, you go home, you conk out, and then you wake up the next morning, you're like, oh my God, I have to sell another 200 bowls of rice. Right? So
In the first place, again, what makes you think that you can sell 200 bowls of rice? It is not easy to sell 200 bowls of rice.
Interesting.
Imagine having to have 200 people like your food
enough
every single day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair.
If you were to add that number up into a year.
I mean, you go to a hawker shop, a hawker center, right? And you will always see three or four stalls that have a line out the wazoo from here to Timbuktu. Yep. And then the poor shop next to it, there's no
one.
I was sitting at
They are the ones that I go to because I don't like the queue.
No, so I was sitting next to the chicken rice stall the other day. I was lying up for the chicken rice shop. It was very good chicken rice, by the way. So worth the whatever 5 or 10 minute wait. Then the food juice shop next to it was empty. And I'm like, I hope the rental for this is cheaper because I see the poor sod standing there looking around.
Yeah, just looking at the queue of the shop.
Right, like, and I can tell you, in their mind, they are just cursing and saying, what the fuck? I should have sold chicken rice. Why am I making juice? I mean, not that they could again have done chicken rice, but I mean, I'm sure they're not particularly happy either.
Fair. Okay, so maybe we want to talk a little bit about the rent side of things. Like, what is the realistic rent? Because I think there's a lot of discussion around like, oh, I know the landlords are taking all the juice, right?
I mean, so I'll spend 2 minutes on it and then let Park talk a bit more about it. But I mean, it varies and it's changed a lot, right? I think back in the day, traditionally, you would say that anything in the CBD is expensive and anything outside of the CBD is cheap. Just stereotypically, right?
Back in the day.
Yeah. But COVID has changed it. I mean, COVID and other things have changed it where now your shop in Tampines or your shop in Jurong or your shop
Everything is consistently as expensive
as the city because the demographics have changed. People are now living in satellite towns in Sengkang or in Jurong or whatever and stuff like that. And your IMM or your... What are the malls in the West? I don't know. Tampines One or whatever can be as busy as... a mall in town, right? Yeah. And so then landlords
Tampines change the is times scary.
And they suddenly say, what was once $10 per $6 per square foot has become $12 per square foot has become $22 per square foot, right?
Now it's about 20
something. Yeah, yeah. It's to a point where HDB has decided to come in to build commercial buildings again.
That's a discussion for another day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, to me, the thing is rental always will be an issue. The bigger problem comes whereby I think nowadays... because I mean it sounds like a grandfather story lah, because I come from at one point it was pretty easy to talk to your landlord. It didn't matter whether your landlord was a big company like say Fire's organization or whatever, you know, but it was easy to talk to them. It was easy to go up to them and be like, hey, you know what, things are not looking so good, you know, I need a bit of help, you know. Could you like, you know, make sure rent is a little bit cheaper or like at least something that can sustain, you know? And they were open to talk. They were open to talk depending on your situation, depending on the type of food. Like if they know that you are likely to succeed, they are open to talk. Whereas nowadays, it's more of a very strict, very simple. If you're not going to pay the amount, someone else is going to pay for it. Right?
Yes.
And because you have all these people in such a rush to throw their money at the landlord.
Yeah.
The landlords are able to just say, like I said, you don't want to pay, someone else will pay.
And it's crazy. It is crazy. And I don't know where the money is coming from, to be honest, where people are willing to bid for rent, right? I mean, I think I've got one, my place that's being taken over right now. So my rental is at X thousand. Someone was willing to pay $1,000 more. Then the other person's like willing to pay $1,000 more. And then I'm like, well, hey, you want to give me the money or not? I mean, where is the money coming from, right? Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then it comes to a point whereby what is now considered cheap rent? I think people no longer have an idea what makes sense anymore. People don't calculate a business that can be sustainable, right? So if let's say you have location A and location B, location B is say $20,000 and then location A is say $15,000. So people will be like, oh, well, $15,000 is cheap. No, it's not. Just because it's lower doesn't mean it's cheap.
Yeah, it's per square foot. It's because location,
it's
not cheap.
It's like $5,000or even like $3,000. That's cheap. Yeah. So people no longer know what is considered cheap rent or even fair rent, right? But you have to come from it from what do you think you will make?
Yeah.
Right? And again, if you calculate your things whereby, oh, I can make $100,000 a month, you know,
everything without sounds cheap.
Yeah, but without a basis of how you're going to make $100,000 a month, then you're factoring in what people shove down your throats.
And when we used to make $100,000 a month, we were fine. The moment we stopped making $100,000 a month, we were dead.
All
right. So
price for perfection. Right? Yeah. You got to be there.
Yeah. No, I mean, at the end of the day, you have fixed costs. You have to build in your fixed costs.
So a lot of people, when they think about coming into F&B, they aim for the stars, but they don't know that very few people will reach there.
They can't hit the moon. They can't hit the atmosphere. They can't hit.
They can't even hit the trees.
And
right?
It takes a while. Yeah. Even if your food is good, sometimes it takes a while for people to know you.
Yeah.
It takes a while for people to get to like try your food and then go and share with your friends and tell people about it.
I want
to
ask a little bit about that because like essentially the longer it takes for someone to get to know you, then there is a run rate, right?
You gotta
carry a run rate 3 months, 6 months, whatever.
I mean, some places have virality lah, so then it depends. So I mean, you've got virality where it's viral and good. And you've got viral where it's viral and like terrible, right? So Cedric Grolet, you can go and look at the reviews. I think it's like 3.2 stars for like a few hundred reviews, right? Because it's like $80 for like a couple croissants and a couple... I haven't tried it. It's near my house, but I'm like, screw this. I'm not going to try this.
It's not even nice in France. Yeah. Just saying.
So, I mean, you know, people have all their... I don't even have to make the comments because the comments are all online versus like, I think I know someone who does like Champion Polo Bao and like Dixon Nasi Lemak, right? Wow, she's done great because
she's
been able to find a niche and say, oh, okay, we can do this. And like, I remember I was talking to her about it and she said, wow, people are complaining to me about my Nasi Lemak being $9. But then there's still a line. So clearly it's good enough to pay $9 for that, right? So she's found that niche. She's been able to find that thing and hit that point where people are like saying, okay, I'm willing to pay $9 for that. I mean, across the street from here, you used to have Coconut Club, right? Mm. Coconut Club was packed. And I can see your point about location. Yeah. It didn't matter. It was always packed. Then a Japanese restaurant moved in after that, Bokashi or something like that, closed within like a year, right? Mm. So it doesn't matter, again, about, to a certain extent, the location or the concept. It's like, is your food good? And if it's good, people are willing to pay $19 for that nasi lemak and it was still packed. And I was willing to go because the food was actually quite good. So from time to time, I would go there makan.
Yeah, right? Shout out to the Coconut Club guys because I always get free.
Oh, so
because they're closing, right?
Yeah.
And I got this extra, you know, not a lot. Like just a few packs.
Is it because guys, you want a coconut? Then you were like,
No. I mean, that's a running joke amongst the team, right? Yeah. So, but yes. Shout out to them. So I get it. And maybe last question, right? Around like working capital, because I think when people are thinking of starting, especially I think for a lot of our listeners, they're more like you, right? Full time corporate job, yep. And then like they got some excess income, then the butt itchy, right? They see a few hundred thousand,
everything
the, itchy. Itchy. Then like, wow, maybe three of us start a restaurant together. Together la, or 3 hours start, but right. That's the narrative.
Yes, don't do it.
Stay away.
That's the narrative. The butt itchy. It's like, hey, not bad lah. We worked hard, man. Let's be our own boss, right? So. I see the face. Oh my god, I'm so allergic to this. But if let's say that's the situation and you were to do it again, you know, to advise people on this thing, right? What is the kind of working capital that they should think about? How many months? What are the numbers? Just give us some stuff.
Do you have
stuff.
Any thoughts first, or?
Okay, based on what I have seen over the years, generally speaking, if let's say you want to open a decent looking restaurant right now, if you include about 3 months of fixed cost, right? And then of course you include, I think, the deposits to the landlord, yeah. etc., everything.
Renovation.
Minimum, $250.
Wow.
Minimum.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely. And that's not even giving you a really nice looking restaurant. That's just a decent looking restaurant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, renovation costs have gone up a lot also. I think when we were doing our second place, I didn't realize COVID really did screw a bunch of things up in terms of like renovation costs also. And so that's definitely been a factor there.
Yeah. And once you go into the hot kitchen, it's even crazier. Like all the insights, all the stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I think when you look at it from the perspective of working capital also, I guess going back to that, it's Park has a good number, but I'd say anywhere from 250 to 500k actually. I mean, it depends on the concept, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could also bootstrap it and just like freaking go to, I mean, I don't know, again, if I wanted to start a concept tomorrow again, which I won't, but if I were to do it again, I actually go and start at a hawker stall. It doesn't have to be a hawker food, right? I just want to do it somewhere where it's low cost. I can do an MVP and I can at least just try out the thing and see whether or not I'll go and bid for the ones where you pay $1 rental
where nobody wants.
Then,
yeah,
and then you get the, I mean, you have to pay the cleaning.
I actually agree with you, right? You know, that's what I'll do. I mean, the thing is, just to clarify, I'm not saying 250 and then suddenly I don't want people to be like, oh, 250 is a great number,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
No, because I wouldn't do it for 250.
Yeah.
I'll put it there. 250 is just a number that I more or less know is out there. But if I were to start another restaurant, I wouldn't spend $250 because I would want to go really cheap on a lot of things. Again, renovation, not a huge thing.
Go and
for
take
me.
Over a space that is, you know? There is no takeover fee or right? whatever and stuff like that, while
so,
everything is there.
Again,
right?
I think a lot of times why this number even exists is because people are too ambitious, right? They want to start with something already like
big
and work. Yeah. So if you were to spend $250 on a restaurant, you better be full house from the first day you open your shop.
No, that's actually a very valid point, right? Because my thought around it is that you say you want to have 3 months of working capital to for people to start coming to your place. But if you're thinking about that from day one, you're screwed. Mm. You're screwed because you should be packed from day one.
Correct.
If you are not, if you're packed from day one and you start to run down, I think that's okay because you can try and find a way. Obviously, the initial excitement show will be a bit more popular. There's a bit of a dip, but then you try and get it back out. But if you're going from this, you're going this way, die. Mm. You'll never gain traction. Correct. You'll never be able
and
to
most
build
of the time, most people will never be able to build that so-called excitement to even start there.
Yeah.
Most of the time, you're talking about what, 95% of concepts. You can tell, you can go on TikTok, lah. You can go on, you know, Instagram, whatever. But most of the time, people are generally like, you know, people will slowly come and then try. And then, you know. So again, if I were to do it, I would be like, I would agree with him. You know, I would go and bid for the shop that's like $1, you know.
Yeah.
I want to get my cost as low as possible to just let people try my food first.
Yeah.
And then you move in. You say, "Wow, the mee pot was so..." Or maybe it doesn't have to be mee pot. The cake was so good. So then the cake, now I can open another shop. So
take over the store next to you. Yeah. That's also $1. Yeah. So now your fixed cost is $2 for rental.
Nice. Are there still areas around there?
Yeah, there are a lot. There are actually plenty.
Because all the coffee shop beating run, right?
No, yeah. Even I was looking, I was even looking at Amoy. I think there was like one... Even though Amoy is popular because of the... There were a couple of shops that like were on their second bid, which means when the second bid means no one actually bid for the first round, right? And... You definitely can find those pockets. So it's not to say that you can't find these things, right?
Nice. I like the MVP idea. Essentially, it's like taking a lot of startup, techie...
Yeah, that's my background, right?
But I think there's validity in that. Especially when you got an intense full-time job and then you want to kind of manage the risk and all
even
that.
If you are doing it as a full-time job and you're so passionate about it and you say, "I have the perfect mee pot recipe," still try it from like the... You don't go and... open it at a nice quick one and then you pay like 20K in rent and then you say, "Oh, everyone come and eat my mee pot and I'm going to be able to sell 200 bowls of $10 mee pot a day."
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I get it. I agree. Yeah. It's essentially why I started at Golden Mile.
Yeah.
I rent this small little office at the top, you know, $500 and you just kind of keep it as lean and then just kind of get it going. Nice. Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
I hope you to see your next iteration.
There's no iteration, but you should. I'll come by my glassware after this.
Okay. Let's chat. And if anybody wants to connect with you guys, like, where can they connect with you? How do they?
For me, it's LinkedIn.
He's super active on LinkedIn.
For me, it's...
come to the restaurant, eat.
You'll see me there, you know.
Just come and look for Pat.
Take that as a consultation fee. At least you get to eat the consultation fee.
That is good.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Enjoy,
thank
guys.
You.
See ya. Bye. Thanks.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.